that line of thought, which is really putting in action, we are going to hear from Deepak Rugani from BioFuelWatch organization.
Just a short presentation looking at the macro picture of globalized hunger in a specific area of biofuels and bioenergy. So I want to begin by just emphasizing that the UK plays a big part in driving targets and incentives, which has a knock-on effect on impacting the rate of land use change, the conversion of natural ecosystems to monocultures, and also the drive for acquiring arable land and putting into the role of energy crop production. And of course that can happen legitimately, so-called, and it can also happen through land grabs. The renewable transport fuel obligation has a particular target of producing 5% of so-called renewable energy within fuels for vehicles by 2013. Now, the ultimate target is 10% within the Eurosphere, and that would require 7 million hectares of land, roughly two times the size of Belgium, of liquid fuel crops such as palm oil or rapeseed oil. A new incentive has just come into play in the last year and a half, called the Renewable Obligation Certificates, which offer an opportunity for corporations to gain from quite literally burning liquid biofuels, often palm oil and rapeseed oil again, sugar cane, but also wood chip and wood pellets, which means that the onslaught on natural forest is now very significant. It's an ironic situation that actually burning wood produces 1.5 times the amount of carbon as burning coal, and yet it's promoted as a green alternative to energy. You may not be able to see it at the bottom, but I'm just hinting here at the aviation industry that's coming up very fast from the rear and pushing hard for subsidies. The Euro demand there is again looking for something like 3.5 million hectares of land that would be required to meet their targets for 2020. Again, that's another area the size of Belgium. And of course, we just don't have that sort of volume of land. The irony about all this is that a number of peer-reviewed papers have been written on this, and they are quite simply ignored. Even the government's own think tanks, like the Renewable Fuels Agency, DEFRA, the European Environment Agency, have all come up with peer-reviewed science emphasizing that agro-energy is a very serious problem, not only just in the Global South, but also in the North, and yet they even ignore their own review, their own researched data. Emphasising the point on this brings us into the issue of a war going on between the competition between food and fuel. We in the North can always afford to pay more money for our fuel than people in the South can for food. And of course it's therefore a weighted combat with the drives and the initiatives of the North always winning out. Of course, there are impacts on many other areas in this vicinity. If you're destroying natural forests to produce wood chip and wood pellets, or if you're destroying it for monocrops for bioenergy, such as palm oil, there's a very significant impact on biodiversity. Why? Because many of these crops are grow best. Palm oil, for example, has the highest energy density of all the liquid oils, liquid vegetable oils, and it grows best in tropical regions with high rainfall. So what you have is a situation where land is being acquired in vast acreages. You've got here where the Penan people in Sarawak just this year lost 1 million hectares, even though they're essentially protected by the Malaysian government. In Sarawak, that was just ignored, and they were pushed off their land. In its place, they were given land that was old oil palm plantation, which of course is not a lot of use to them. We have a situation which I want to link to now. I've hinted strongly that there are impacts on food production. I've also implied that when you push indigenous peoples out of their land, there's a food crisis created there, not as well as a cultural crisis. There's also a biodiversity crisis. But there's something else that's very often not talked about, and this is a thing I really would like to move towards the end of my presentation on, and it's something I'd like it to stick in your heads if there was one thing that you remembered, because it really isn't mentioned elsewhere. And that's the issue that when we start incentivizing the use of bioenergy, land becomes the finite resource, as it always is in many other things to do with food. And The land that's being grabbed, as I said, is that ribbon of tropical forests around the equator, which is the favourite focus of attention. And what we're starting to see here is now greater inroads being made into the large contiguous rainforests, the Congo Basin and the Amazonian rainforest in particular. And this is causing a very severe additional effect, and that is the spread of wildfires during the dry season. Now, we used to have one very large fire about every 100 years. It's now increased to about one every 12 years. The last one was last year in 2010. The left-hand picture was taken by the NASA Aqua satellite and shows the extent of fire outbreak. Most of that is legitimate fire that has been caused as a result of monoculture, because unlike the multi-canopied, humid space of a rainforest, when it's converted into monoculture, you've effectively got a very dry environment, but one that also dries out the soils. So they become very susceptible to further drying of the peripheral regions of the forest, creating a tinderbox atmosphere which goes up in flames under high temperatures. So you're getting the monocrop areas being the source of the fires in many situations. We're also seeing unscrupulous logging companies paying local people to deliberately initiate fires, because when the forest is gone, they don't have to worry about winning a logging concession. If it's gone, they can actually start converting it. So this is happening quite widely. Of course, it's heavily incentivized by the sort of legislation that we're having here. Renewable obligation certificates are being offered for bioenergy in the form of wood chip and wood pellets, which is driving this kind of destruction. It's not just being offered, which it should never be, because it's far cheaper to build a bioenergy power station without any subsidies compared to the high infrastructure costs of wind, but it's actually being subsidized by the ratio of 2-1. So you would get twice as much subsidies for burning bioenergy, liquid bioenergy or solid, than you would for putting an onshore wind turbine, which is absolutely mad. And that's the situation that we're in today. We have a review coming up, the government's review on renewable energy. It's the Renewable Obligation Certificates Review, just about to start in the next few weeks. They haven't initiated a date yet. But it'd be wonderful if NGOs in the room would come together and actually submit an application, a response to the consultation. We will have one published on the Biofuel Watch website. Feel free to take liberally from that. Of course, use your own wording. But the point is that unless we put pressure on government to recognise that the incentives for bioenergy, both liquid and solid, is driving an unparalleled conversion of land, both natural habitat and arable land, we're not going to win this battle. In fact, the situation is moving markedly worse. And just the point I wanted you to remember on this, that this has a very serious impact, obviously directly on food production, but it also has an impact indirectly, because contiguous rainforests are the drivers of our global rainfall cycles. The Amazon rainforest, for example, drives the rainfall cycle in both hemispheres. Without the Amazon, North America, Central America, and South America would be in drought, and we wouldn't have the food production we'd have today. You could effectively remove something like 3 billion people off the planet if that was to happen. Now, we're getting closer to that. If we're having large fires every 12 years, we're only a step away from what are described as megafires. Large fires burn at something like 200 to 400 degrees. A megafire burns at something like 1,000 to 1,200 degrees. They don't just burn all the biomass above the ground, they burn the underground seed, the rooting structures, and all the soil fauna below the ground, turning it into virtual deserts. And that's what we face if we end up getting to a critical tipping point where rainforests actually lose their purposeful function as driving rainfall cycles. And you can see some of that starting to happen already. I'm not saying this is to do with tropical rainforests, but even in Britain, we've lost our April showers for 2 years now, and they've reappeared in June or July. So that kind of rainfall cycle breakdown is already starting to happen. And I haven't got time to explain this now, but we've had one serious case at Bristol go against us, where a power station was actually voted against by the local council, and now has been overruled by central government, and it's now being pushed ahead, and it will burn primarily palm oil to the tune of requiring something like 10 to 15,000 hectares of land to be converted to produce the palm oil just for this one biofuel power station. And the very last slide, I just wanted to show you, this is a peer-reviewed study by Wise Marshall in Science magazine last year. And what I really want to emphasize here is we're here down at 2010-12, where most of our unmanaged forests are intact. Most of our unmanaged pasture land is intact. Well, it's the unmanaged forests and pasture land that drive the global rainfall cycles, and grasslands as well, I'm including grasslands in that. What happens by the year of 2050, when you're 2065, between that sort of period, if we continue with the drive for bioenergy, is we see these areas completely converted into bioenergy cropland. Now that, symbolically, is an end to our global regular global rainfall cycles. And if you end our rainfall cycles, you lose the opportunity to seed at a certain time of the year and to crop or harvest at another time of the year. And that effectively means the end of abundant food availability for the vast majority of human society. Thank you.
The question is environmentally friendly at the cost of who or what? And that leads us into something as part of the ending the globalization of hunger. We got Helen from Scopoli.
My name's Helen. I work for Friends of the Earth, and we're part of the Tescopoli Alliance, of which Bore on Want is also a member, and other environment and development groups. And the Tescopoli Alliance was set up a few years ago in response to the increasing power of the supermarkets, to highlight the negative impacts that supermarket power has, and to challenge that supermarket power. I'm just going to talk about three different areas of work that we're working on at the moment. Firstly, the supermarket ombudsman, which we're campaigning for. Secondly, planning reform, which Jeanette spoke about earlier. And thirdly, community campaigns against supermarkets in people's local areas. So in terms of the supermarket power, we have the big four controlling 3/4 of the grocery market. We have Tesco alone controlling 1/3 of the grocery market. And this gives them immense buyer power with which to drive down prices paid to farmers and to use abusive supply chain practices. The Competition Commission in 2008 did an inquiry into the grocery market sector, and they found that the supermarkets are using abusive supply chain practices. And they recommended a supermarket ombudsman, which is now being called a grocery code adjudicator. So that was in 2008. We saw the three main political parties all put in their manifestos that they were committing to establishing a supermarket ombudsman or a grocery code adjudicator. It was in the coalition plan for government, but yet 3 years after the Competition Commission reported, we're still waiting for the supermarket ombudsman to come into force. So that's one thing that we're campaigning for a robust, a strong supermarket watchdog with teeth that will stop the supermarkets abusing their buyer power. Secondly, on the planning system, so we have major planning reform underway at the moment, which threatens to open up even more of the grocery market to the big four supermarkets. So as I say, already we have 3/4 of the grocery market belonging to the big four supermarkets. The planning policy, which was about increasing retail diversity and supporting town centre first, is being radically weakened with the planning proposals that are being put forward in the National Planning Policy Framework. So we need to be campaigning to make sure that a town centre first policy remains, and that there's more retail diversity, more small shops, more support for genuine choice for consumers. We're supporting small shops because we believe they're better for the local economy, they employ more people per retail floor space, they keep more money recycled in the local economy, and they're better for local food. So that's one reason why we're campaigning for small shops. And then lastly, on the community campaigns, on the Tescopoli website, we have over 400 community campaigns. So this is local groups campaigning against supermarkets in their area. Unfortunately, because the planning system is stacked in the favour of the supermarkets, last year, for example, 82% of all new retail floor space went to the big four. Unfortunately, it's very difficult for communities to campaign against, but they are winning. There's a fight back happening at the local level, so we need more support for communities to campaign against unwanted supermarket developments and to support genuine retail choice, genuine local food, small shops and markets. So just in summary, the three areas: we want a supermarket ombudsman to stop abusive supply chain practices, we want stronger planning reform to support small shops and local economies, and we need more support for communities who are campaigning against unwanted supermarkets.
Before going to the last principle, or the two, I should say. I want to give the voice to someone that is coming from Somerset and from Glastonbury, and she's representing the community, the Somerset community food. And I think it's really relevant what Helen was saying about community campaigning and support to community groups. So Nicole Wasper.
Hi, I'm from a charity called Somerset Community Food. We're just a local charity that helps people to get growing food, basically. But for the past year, we've been working on a thing called Food Mapper. Now, Food Mapper is a digital mapping tool that lets communities and individuals map local growing spaces. So we've got like allotment sites on maps that you can like map online. And it's a way of protecting them, basically, from development. You can also map initiatives, whether that's food cooperatives, local shops selling local food, local farmers, local producers. And it's basically just to make our food systems visible. So if we're trying to work for food sovereignty in the UK, we need to make sure that if people want to buy local food, they know where to buy it from. If they want to grow, they know where to grow. And we can also map demand for land. So we've been mapping where the waiting lists are in Somerset. So we know that there's over 200 people on a waiting list in South Somerset to grow food. And it's a way then of actually showing we've got demand for land down here. I know in Brazil, the government once said, oh, you don't have that many landless farmers, it's not true. And they did loads of research and they proved that they had that many people who were wanting land. So in the UK, if we can map this demand for land, then it means that we can create more growing spaces. So it's called foodmapper.org.uk, and it's just a way of making our food systems visible. And we're hoping for it to go national. So we're hoping that community groups, transition groups, permaculture projects can use Food Mapper in their communities. Can I plug Reclaim the Fields?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
my other hat is organising with a group called Reclaim the Fields. It started off as a kind of youth wing of Via Campesina and then split off. And over the past few years in Europe, there's been different gatherings and networks trying to develop what it could mean for us. And in the UK, in March this year, we had our first UK gathering, and then one in Bristol in the summer, and more recently down in Dorset. And we're basically a grassroots constellation of people, mainly young people at the moment, but we're totally open to everyone, who are working to reclaim food production in the UK. So there's all sorts of things going on, potential land occupations next year. We organise solidarity actions with local growing spaces such as Grow Hoofo, who are facing eviction this year. And we basically want to make growing cool again, you know, for young people to get involved in it. And we hope that we can be a force of challenging the land inequalities that exist in the UK, the concentration of land ownership and the huge power of supermarkets. And we're just basically trying to mobilise people across the UK. So our website is reclaimthefields.org.uk. There's quite a few of us here today, so come and grab us and say hello. And yeah, that's who we are.
Thank you, Nicole. Helen is the National Secretary of the NOMA campaigns in Kenya. She's a farmer, a dairy and maize farmer. Is that right? Tell it.
I don't know what time it is in UK, but I would like to say good afternoon.
Yeah, it's almost 12:13.
As you have heard, I'm Helen Yego from Kenya. I'm a farmer, doubling up with farmer campaigns through our farmers movement called Ngoma, which is a Swahili local language word for maize and dairy farmers campaign. I have been given the topic to talk about social peace. And being one of the principles of food sovereignty, what I'd like to say is that food is culturally based. What people eat in one part of the world is not what other people eat in another part of the world. It depends on culture's preferences. And so the different food varieties that we have is actually socially land and socially, it is a social peace in natural sense, because you eat what you like. And what you eat is what you have produced in your own locality. So we have different foods culminating from different food preferences. And so food is as diverse as we are also human beings. We have different people from different parts of the world, China, India, Africa, Europe, and all this kind of thing. And so what I'd like to say about social peace is that, therefore, there's no way that food can be controlled from a central point and people to be forced to access that food from central point. As we have had the multinationals, the supermarkets, making everybody go for the same thing, and that is not possible. That culminates into crime against humanity, and also it becomes social insecurity to our lives. So, food producers must come up strongly against this by protecting our basic right, by protecting our own socially, culturally, socialized food that we are used to. And the point is, how do we challenge the great greed coming from the agribusiness industry, which is causing social wars into food and ripping the farmers of their earned profit? Why I'm talking about this is because the case in Kenya, the people who are now driving food production are the agribusiness companies that are selling their fertilizers, their chemicals, their all sorts of things that they tell us that if we use it in our soils, it will enrich our food, it will do all this. And farmers get enticed into buying all these things and spoiling our soils and spoiling our food varieties. So we have a great challenge to challenge the agribusiness companies. The other thing is, the case with Kenya is that we have people living in the drier areas of our country. And these are the people that I know you see greatly in the news about drought. These people have their own food systems. They have their own strong food systems that is totally ignored by the systems that we have, because our governments have used these dry areas to be their catch-22 for food aid, getting food relief so that they can make huge profits out of the food relief that they get out of our drier areas. The point is, the drier areas, we have resistant crops, which they grow at a season when they know how to grow it, and that is their stable food. And what they do is that they eat those resistant crops, the biomass that they get out of it, they feed it to their animals because they are actually pastoralists. But what is the system doing to them? They are frustrating their efforts in order to use them to solicit for relief foods for their own selfish gain. So this is actually a case whereby they're using food as a weapon to hit at us. But when you come now to the control, the democratic control. Is it there? Oh. Okay, fine. If the world is talking about democracy, then all people of walks of life have the right to make an input to what pertains to their everyday life. But it is no longer the preserve of the few, and that can decide for everybody without making consultation. Food producers have a right to participate in decision making on their policies. But the question is, how do we get to have the voice of everybody in a world dominated by multinationals who think that they have all the solutions to food crises, making decisions for us through trade, through GMO, and external inputs? In essence, they are totally wrong, because their policies do not augur well with our own country's policies. There are a lot of conflicting information. But the puzzling question, especially to us in the developing countries, the question is, how do we distinguish between democracy and aid? aid conditionalities in developing world are the enemy of democracy. And there is need for political will to have inclusive participation by all citizens of the countries on decisions and access to information. And what we want to say is that we thank God for internet, which has at least brought forth the use of information that used to be taken to be secrets, but now we can access it through the internet. But the question is, are we in the developing countries in line or at par with the IT technology? Or do we even have this IT technology to our doorsteps? And so as producers, we see that we have a big challenge to step up our demands to have also development of IDs and other things into our doorsteps. And I think that's all I can talk about.
Thank you.